Today on Against the Grain. Every day, the police kill someone in America. But in the last several years, widespread anger about police violence has led many to take to the streets. And the prevailing model of policing, known as broken windows, seems to be in crisis. What will replace it? And how should we understand the role that the police play in maintaining the social order? I'm Sasha Lilly. Radical scholar Christina Heatherton joins me to discuss policing, neoliberal capitalism, and resistance. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Last week, the Department of Justice released a report about the Baltimore Police Department in the wake of the death of Freddie Gray while in police custody last year, which led to social unrest in that city. Like police departments around the United States, Baltimore has subscribed to broken windows policing, in which poor people and people of color are criminalized for small infractions like jaywalking or spitting. While much attention has been paid to so-called police abuses, much less has been given to the whys of policing in America. What purpose does it serve? The editors of a new book have sought to examine the links between policing and neoliberal capitalism. They ask the questions, is community policing a good alternative to broken windows policing, or should policing as we know it be abolished? The book is titled Policing the Planet, Why the Policing Crisis Led to Black Lives Matter, and I'm very pleased to be joined by its co-editor, Christina Heatherton. She's assistant professor of American Studies at Trinity College. Christina, let me start by asking you about last week's Department of Justice report about policing in Baltimore. The report detailed repeated stops of African Americans by the police over the suspicion of minor infractions and concluded that the system had systemic deficiencies that, quote, failed to equip officers with the tools they need to police effectively. What do you conclude from that report?
This Department of Justice report on the Baltimore Police Department, just like the Department of Justice report on the Ferguson Police Department, has, is a very helpful document as much as it reestablishes what we already know. So what do I mean by that? What we saw in Baltimore, just as what we saw in Ferguson, was quite simply over-policing, and not just any kind of over-policing, but as this most recent report shows, over-policing of minor crimes of poverty. So, just like the Ferguson report, the Baltimore report talks a lot about the policing of minor traffic infractions. The regular routine stops of people for everything from loitering to trespassing to Freddie Gray was stopped for looking suspicious. Broken windows policing is perhaps the specific name for the kind of policing that produced the crises both in Ferguson and in Baltimore. Broken windows policing is the policing of small, petty offenses, crimes of poverty, with the theory that these prevent bigger crimes from happening down the line. Now, what we've seen in Ferguson, in Baltimore, in New York, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in Albuquerque, everywhere in the country where there's been a response either under the banner of Black Lives Matter or just in response to police killing, has been both outrage over the killing itself as well as an outrage over the over-policing of these mundane offenses, which, as we argue in the book, is what ultimately sets the stage and makes people vulnerable for what end up being fatal encounters with the police. But there's one other thing I just wanted to add about Baltimore that I think is very interesting that I hope we can talk about as well. You know, last week I saw an interview with Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, who was thinking through the report and, reasserted this point that you made, that police simply don't have the tools they need for adequate policing. In the book, we talk a lot about this trap that we believe that poor policing police brutality, police killing, over-policing, that these are just the result of police not having the proper capacity, funding, training. And what we've seen, particularly over the late 20th and early 20th century, are these proposals for policing reform, which quite simply just re-entrench and expand funding for policing. So as the crisis of policing gets greater and greater, as police are authorized to use, you know, to extend their capacity, we keep seeing these proposals for change being just funding more of the same thing. So at the outset, I just want to say that, you know, we put this book together in an effort to say we need to be able to think differently. Whoever sets the agenda wins the debate, and quite frankly, right now, we are not setting the agenda as long as we're responding to these police killings and Department of Justice reports and not being able to articulate what kind of policing we're experiencing right now.
What are the origins of broken windows policing? How long has it been with us? Where did it come from?
Well, there are two origin stories associated with broken windows policing. The first and most commonly told is that James Q. Wilson and George Kelling, a criminologist and a political scientist, wrote an article in the Atlantic magazine in 1982 that, you know, spelled out this theory of broken windows and, you know, in that article produced this very durable and enduring metaphor of a broken window. And their idea, the metaphor goes that if a window in an abandoned house in a neighborhood remains broken, it's a signal to people that nobody's tending to that space. And so it'll encourage smaller crimes. People will start littering and loitering. And then that, in turn, produces a crimogenic environment where larger crimes can happen. So this was a, you know, it played on a lot of commonsensical ideas, both about crime, but also about public order and safety. And so a lot of people credit this as the kind of origin moment of broken windows. Obviously, there were other experiments with broken windows before. In the article, they're talking about an experiment that took place in Newark, New Jersey in the 70s. And so the other origin story is, you know, actually backdates broken windows policing to an earlier period. So not only was the practice of, you know, over-policing small petty crimes in an effort to stop bigger ones, you know, experimented on prior to 82. But in the book, you know, we try to talk about how this form of policing actually emerged out of the urban uprisings of the 1960s and the 1970s, when a whole host of policing reforms were produced that, you know, had to respond to the uprisings that were happening then against rampant police brutality and police killings. And so we really see broken windows policing as emerging not just out of response to those uprisings, but also, as we say throughout the book, at the advent of neoliberalism. This is a form of policing that takes shape. It emerges within, amidst, and alongside the advent of neoliberalism. And we think this is very important for understanding why it works.
And I'd like to ask you more about that. Broken windows and neoliberalism. But I'd like to ask you first, when you were describing broken windows and the, as you say, supposedly sort of commonsensical logic of it, the notion of disorder is a sort of central one. What is this fear of a kind of sweeping disorder?
Well, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Like a lot of these terms, like safety, disorder is a very subjective term, and it's a very subjective term to leave to police discretion, as if decisions could be made about it objectively instead of subjectively. So, you know, the question of what constitutes disorder changes from place to place. For example, I just moved to a new apartment in Hartford, Connecticut. If I drank a bottle of liquor in front of my apartment, I would not get stopped. Now, if you go into poorer parts of Hartford or most cities, if you go into communities of color, people who are drinking from open containers are going to be stopped. So what does not count as disorder in one place constitutes disorder in another. And, I mean, there are race and class dimensions as to what how those determinations are made. And so what constitutes disorder are very subjective. They're crimes of poverty. But as we like to point out, you know, this is not a just kind of willy-nilly arbitrary enforcement of the law in different places. There's been of logic to the way in which different forms of quote-unquote public disorder have been criminalized. We spent a lot of time in the book talking about Skid Row, Los Angeles, which is the, you know, has long been the homeless capital of the U.S., has the highest concentration of poverty in Los Angeles, where you see just, you know, not only an over-policing of broken windows policing for crimes of disorder, but you also see how this form of policing has gone hand-in-hand with the redevelopment and gentrification of the area. So people's behavior becomes criminal at the same time that the space in which they inhabit becomes attractive for capital.
So do you think that the fear of this kind of disorder is to do with making cities attractive, or a fear of political unrest, or some combination of the two?
Definitely some combination of the two, with a logic that shifted over time. I mean, I would say at the outset that a lot of what constituted disorder when this form of policing emerged was just a fear of integration, actually. And, you know, if you look at some of the original documents that, you know, some of the writings that James Q. Wilson and George Kelling, the so-called authors of Broken Windows, were doing prior to the 80s, they're very explicit that what constitutes disorder for them are things like men with long hair, women out late at night, Black people in general. And so you see, you know, there's heteronormative, homophobic, extremely racist, you know, notions of order that they feel should compel a different form of policing of public space. The point that we try to make again and again in the book is that Broken Windows presents itself as a policy that's supposed to make people safer, when in actuality, if you look at the history of the implementation of Broken Windows throughout the United States and in turn its exportation around the world, we see that Broken Windows policing does not make cities safer for people. It makes cities safer for capital and for new investments of capital.
Christina Heatherton is my guest. She is co-editor of Policing the Planet, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, let's talk then about capital. And you mentioned neoliberalism, the way that capitalism was restructured, the form that it took starting in the 70s. Can you tell us what was happening, since you're saying that that reshaping of capitalism and Broken Windows should be understood as being connected? Can you tell us what was happening in American cities in the 1970s when neoliberalism took shape that helps us understand the rise of Broken Windows?
Sure. Well, there's, you know, obviously an enormous transformation that happens under the banner of what we call neoliberalism, or what I prefer to talk about as neoliberalization, and that is thinking about neoliberalism as a process that has not yet been achieved. I think we get ourselves in all kinds of conceptual traps when we think about it as fait accompli. So neoliberalization, when we think about some of these major political and economic transformations that began in earnest in the 70s, although there are definitely arguments about how there were earlier precedents for it, we're thinking primarily of major transformations in the political economy, such as deindustrialization, such as offshoring. And I think what's critical, I could talk a lot about neoliberalism and neoliberalization, but for our purposes, some of the transformations that are really critical are the ways in which cities changed as the political economy, as their political economies changed. And what do I mean by this? If you had, just pure and simple, if you had cities that had economic engines of industry, for example, so, you know, we can think maybe most vibrantly of a place like Detroit, although we could think about Los Angeles, we could think about any other major American cities. If you think about how central the economic engine of that city was, and you think about the ways in which the state was invested in the reproduction of the you know, the working class of that city, of maintaining that economic engine. You know, there's, how do I put it? There's a kind of commonsensical way that, you know, you have to maintain roads because people have to get to work. You have to maintain schools because you want an educated next generation of workers to work for that factory, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So when you see a shift in the political economy, when you see industrialization, when you see the former economic engines of U.S. cities shifting, moving, leaving, that former economic engine being destroyed, you're also seeing a transformation of the state. It no longer is invested in reproducing the population of those cities to work in those centers. And so a big part of, you know, a significant aspect of neoliberalism that's important for understanding broken windows policing is, what do you do when suddenly you have all these people out of work, when you have, you know, abandoned factories, when you know, you essentially have a new surplus population to manage. Now, a lot of people have written, particularly Ruth Wilson Gilmore, about how prisons have emerged in this period to manage that surplus population. And so when we're thinking about broken windows policing, we're thinking about policing as a form of management for those populations. And I suppose I should just add one other thing. In the same period, as you see the decline of industrial production, you also see the rise of, you know, what are called the fire sectors, finance, insurance, and real estate. And this is really important to see because cities take on a new function. Instead of being centers of social reproduction, they become sites of real estate investment, of financialization. And so the ways in which surplus populations get managed, the ways in which people become, you know, expendable to the process of capital accumulation is reflected in the form of policing that emerges. So it's not as if, you know, policing full stop is just always invested in being so racist and so terrible. We can talk about kind of trans-historical definitions of policing, but to think specifically about what changes in the functioning of policing from the 70s to the present, we have to think about what changed in terms of the political economy, what changed in the functioning of cities, how did cities go from sites of production to sites of capital investment, and what did you have to do with the people who got in the way with that process? You arrested them.
Let me ask you more about that than the whole question of a surplus. So one thinks of capitalism as a system that always needs surpluses, a surplus population, that is, because having a larger pool of workers than is needed at any time means that there's the ability to pick from other workers and drive wages down, whereas if there were just the number of workers that the system needed, they would have a whole lot more social power, which, of course, is one of the things one can see during economic booms, that workers tend to have a bit more power because they're more needed. At what point does this surplus become a problem, or is it always a problem that needs to be managed as well as a benefit for the system?
So, yes. I mean, capitalism always requires a surplus population. And I, you know, really like Ruthie Gilmore's formulation that capitalism requires inequality. And racism enshrines it, and those things are always important to think about together. So what changes, you're asking, in the present moment? And I think, you know, part of the way that you have to think about a kind of a renewed approach to managing surplus populations under neoliberalism, you know, is thinking about it relative to how conditions have worsened for the working class. So I'll perhaps approach this question somewhat indelicately, and just offer a few observations. I, by the way, think that Craig Wilsey's The Value of Homelessness does an excellent job addressing this particular question. But I think as conditions worse, as wages have stagnated, as the sectors of economic growth for, you know, employment have been in the service industry, the kind of relative force necessary to compel the working class to consent to accept this order, I think, requires a higher level of coercion. So, you know, the kind of threat of becoming a part of that surplus population is different relative to the stability of different economic sectors. So there's something to be said about, you know, just the kind of dire circumstances we're in right now, where not only are people having to work more and more for less and less, but you also see, and I'm sorry I didn't mention this earlier, under neoliberalism, the stripping of public goods, of social services. And so not only are people working for less money, they're also having to individually subsidize what the state is no longer providing. So if there is impaired transportation, schools, health, people are having to reach into their own pocket to pay for those things because they are not socialized. So, you know, there's a whole kind of constellation that I think requires new forms of coercion. And let me just say this, because I think this is really important. When we talk about that kind of coercion, you know, there's definitely the management and the warehousing of surplus populations in prison. But not everybody who's surplus is warehoused. I think what we have to confront at this moment is the threat, the fear, the sense that people are walking warrants, that they're targets in American cities right now, because the threat of their removal, their bodily violation, their beating, their arrest, to their killing, hangs over people so profoundly. And so when we're talking about managing surplus populations, I think the inculcation of that kind of fear, the production of, you know, why did Freddie Gray run? Right? Understanding that there's such a great chance that terrible harm can come to your body and that nobody will be held accountable to it. That is its own form of coercion that also makes this system work.
That is the voice of Christina Heatherton. We'll return with her in a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the co-editor of Policing the Planet, Why the Policing Crisis Led to Black Lives Matter. That's published by Verso. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. My guest is Christina Heatherton. She's Assistant Professor of American Studies at Trinity College and author of the forthcoming book, The Color Line and the Class Struggle, The Mexican Revolution, Internationalism, and the American Century. So you've been describing a situation where under neoliberal capitalism, you have the cutting back of the welfare state while the punitive aspects of the state have increased. So you have poor people who have become even more precarious, while at the same time the state is more likely to punish them for things such as traffic tickets or worse. So just to sort of spell it out explicitly, what role then do the police play under neoliberalism? What do you see as their key function?
Building off this last point about understanding a kind of redistribution of social goods, you know, when you see, money continually stripped from a depleted welfare state alongside the expansion of policing and prisons, what you see continually is a confrontation of that particular form of distribution or redistribution. So, for example, in Los Angeles right now, there is a budget for homelessness to address homelessness. It's a budget of $100 million. $87 million of that $100 million goes to policing. So, what we try to talk about a lot in the book is how policing have, you know, because you have the expansion of the punitive sector of the state alongside the depletion of you know, the social services of the state, you have all these different instances where police are stepping in and serving these social functions. And a lot of people have written about the disaster when it's the police that are called in to be school disciplinarians, when the police are called in to be mental health facilitators, when the police are the ones who are guarding public space. And I think a lot of the high-profile police killings that we've seen recently, you know, are, like, elaborate this. Eric Garner's killed on a Staten Island street by police who are regulating the space for the sale of untaxed commodities. Tamir Rice is killed by police that are guarding a public park. Akai Gurley's killed, you know, by police that are guarding public housing. And I think even more drastically, you know, there's a lot of ink spilled about the militarization of the police as if that's what constitutes the crisis at this moment. You know, but we forget that, you know, Eric Garner was strangled to death. Freddie Gray was killed by a police van. He was killed on a rough ride. He was killed by a Baltimore street, by those unpaved, bumpy streets in those poor neighborhoods that police rode over to break his neck, although, you know, officially he broke his own neck. So I think we always have to think about this configuration. Money is getting depleted from social sectors. It's getting grossly invested into policing and prisons as if this is going to be the solution to all our social problems. And as a result, the police are producing and delimiting particular spatialities of what we come to understand as public goods and public space, and this has had fatal consequences for people across the country.
Well, as you're indicating, the police have no lack of funding, and yet isn't one of the ways that the role of the police and the way the police function has changed is that there are also sort of new revenue streams that flow in to fund them?
Absolutely, absolutely. And what's important for, you know, activists and organizers as well as scholars who are keeping an eye on this is that so often these new funding sources are legitimated by our calls for reform. So, you know, if you just look at what's on the table right now, whether it's body cameras, diversity training, hiring more, you know, officers from communities of color, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There are a number of calls for reform that align with what Naomi Murakawa, one of our contributors, talks about as this fiction of making the police more procedurally just, as if we can just produce new laws, new training programs, new, you know, non-lethal weapons, and these forms of investment will somehow, you know, alleviate the problems of policing that we're facing. Now, you know, what we've seen in actuality since this language was introduced in the 60s and 70s is that, you know, there's not always instructions for how the money ought to be spent. And so, as you said, you know, calls for reform sound great at a press conference when in actuality all they end up being is new revenue streams for police, which means new investment in the same old thing. And so, you know, as the question of policing is being brought to the fore in this country, we really have to think deeply and systematically about not calling for things that are simply just going to build and make stronger and richer the you know, the very problem that we're trying to dismantle.
You mentioned a moment ago that there's been a great deal of attention paid to the militarization of the police, perhaps to the detriment of seeing the larger picture, that it's not simply just about the militarization of the police. But I did want to ask you, how do you see the connection, and this is something that contributors to Policing the Planet, your book, touch on, how is U.S. policing exported abroad, and then how is policing in the U.S. connected to U.S. imperial policies overseas?
Right. This is a big topic that we take up in the book, and we address it in a multitude of ways. First of all, we speak with organizers who are thinking through how the kind of everyday racist broken windows policing in U.S. cities has, in effect, seeded the ground so that in places, you know, in parts of Los Angeles, that were already over-policed with broken windows policies have, you know, subsequently become testing grounds and launching pads for major Department of Homeland Security initiatives, which then get exported to the U.S. military. And, you know, some of these activists that we talk to talk about a kind of long history of those kind of circulations, U.S. police departments training, for example, police and military squads and officials from parts of Central America and the Middle East. You know, we think about William Bratton, who's been the chief kind of promoter and spokesperson of Broken Windows Policing, producing ties between the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and U.S. police departments. And so there's definitely a kind of circulation of broken windows policing that, you know, you can kind of map out where people go, where Rudolph Giuliani has gone as a consultant, where Bratton has gone as a consultant, you know, and there's concrete ways in which broken windows policing has been globalized, you know, simply by virtue of the movement of those kind of people and policies. But we also think about policing in terms of flows. And we have a fantastic interview with Arun Kudnani, who talks about, you know, being really attendant to the long history of colonial policing and the ways in which it integrates with our understanding of population management. And so he talks about the phenomenon of total policing, deeply integrating policing with all social services. That this is a practice that comes from the colonial management, the British colonial management of people in places like Kenya, which then gets exported to places like Northern Ireland, which then gets imported into cities like London, and then becomes a part of the kind of policing apparatus that we see in U.S. cities. So, you know, there's a multi-directional way in which these flows take place, but it's extremely important that we think about these things all at once, and I think it's a difficult thing to wrap our heads around. You know, it's when we're talking about these connections between domestic and foreign militarism, sometimes it's easiest to see it when we have tanks on U.S. streets, but we really have to think about it at the level of the legitimacy of policies, the process of enemy making, the ways in which, you know, there's been a much longer and deeper flow and circulation of ideas that's preceded this moment.
Well, in the course of this discussion, Christina Heatherton, you've talked about how broken windows policing has been spurred by, on the one hand, a reaction to social unrest in American cities in the 60s before then, and so a kind of concern with keeping things orderly, and then at the same time, the transformation of American cities as a site of business investment, a place where people with great amounts of money would like to keep the streets pristine and have no homeless people around. And so people have been banished and pushed out and criminalized over all sorts of minor things. But what we're also seeing, though, is that the broken windows approach, this approach to focus on minor infractions as a way of keeping people feeling like they are always being watched, that they may end up being hauled off to jail, that they're constantly being policed, in effect. What we're seeing now is that that kind of intensive ground-level policing also can actually produce a great deal of unrest. How do you understand the sort of social unrest and pushback that we have seen in the last few years in response to high-profile police killings, but also a much greater awareness of the degree to which particular populations are being policed over all sorts of minor things?
Well, you know, a similar question was posed to me in a slightly different way, where somebody said, you know, are the police actually killing people more, or are we just more aware of it? And, you know, in other words, do people deserve to be angrier than they were before? I think what partly explains the uprisings at this moment is the fact that this form of policing has lost its legitimacy. So the former, you know, racial panics that would have excused extrajudicial murders, right? The former racial moral panics that would have said, oh, well, Eric Garner was a criminal, Tanisha Anderson was a, you know, a black crazy woman, Alton Sterling had a whole rap sheet. I mean, the things that get dredged up in attempt to justify these filmed extrajudicial murders, they've lost their purchase. And there's a lot of reasons why they've lost their purchase, but to simply answer your question, I think part of the reason that you're seeing these uprisings at this moment is that, you know, that old script is just, it's not working. And I feel like what is being unveiled at this moment is, you know, the anxiety of a regime aware of its own illegitimacy. You know, things are coming apart. You cannot simply deploy force and expect people to take it. But I feel like, as you know, a number of theorists of neoliberalism have said, force is a last resort, and the fact that it's being leaned on so heavily tells us something very important about the legitimacy of the neoliberal project at this moment.
Given that the broken windows model of policing appears to be in crisis, obviously those in the state are not about to just chuck policing away. So if this form is in crisis, there's an alternative model that they hope to replace it with as a maybe a more effective means of policing?
Yeah, absolutely. Community policing being promoted as the alternative to broken windows policing. And so, you know, this is the idea that you get more community input, enhance dialogue between police and communities they serve. It's a very fungible term that kind of means whatever a police officer needs it to mean at a press conference after they've killed another person. And, you know, the point that we make throughout the book is that it's there's no difference between broken windows policing and community policing. William Bratton himself says community policing is the most vivid example of broken windows policing there is. This has essentially been there's been a series of efforts to rebrand broken windows policing as if it takes into account, you know, all of the outrage and unrest that people have been expressing around the country. And sometimes it's called community policing, sometimes it's called neighborhood policing, it's called all kinds of ridiculous names, with the idea that you're actually reducing the power of police and increasing the power of community input, when in actuality, if you're not changing any funding structures, if public money is going disproportionately to policing and prisons, if there is nothing in place to actually change the form and function of policing, it doesn't matter what you call it, it will, you know, will have the same result. So, you know, we've been very fortunate in the production of the book and in discussions of the book afterwards to talk with people who are trying to get ahead of that curve. Because if we expend all our energy thinking about the policing crisis is, you know, just a question of this form of policing, and we can't see what happens when it's, you know, put into new bottles, we're in big trouble. But this is the next iteration that's already unfolding.
Yes, and do you think there's the danger that people who would like to see real changes to policing are unwittingly playing into this? Because, of course, dialogue and community, those are those warm, fuzzy words that often you hear people who are self-identified as progressive or people who would like to see social change using.
Yes. This book is written from an abolitionist perspective. Now, there's a lot of different interpretations of what abolitionism means at present. What does it mean to call for the abolition of the police? And, you know, I think what's been so important about the ways in which Ruthie Gilmore, Angela Davis, theorists of abolition have talked about it is abolition is not just a question of dismantling something. It's also a question of rebuilding something. You know, the notion comes from the period of black reconstruction, you know, articulated by Du Bois, this concept of abolition democracy. You can't have a society premised on the exclusion of anybody. You know, you have the construction of institutions that are about producing, you know, more justice, more freedom, the orientation of contributors to our book are always thinking about this kind of dialectic. If you're saying we don't need this kind of policing, then how are you diagnosing the problem and what are you proposing as the solution? And so throughout, we have different iterations from, you know, people like Ju-Hyun Kung, who was the director of Communities United for Police Reform. We have Patrice Cullors, one of the co-founders and co-visionaries of Black Lives Matter. We have a host of organizers that are all trying to think very concretely in their communities. What are the problems that people are facing? Is it a problem of jobs? Is it a problem of housing? These are simple, basic problems that people are facing that simply, you know, simply funding policing, increasing funding for policing are not going to solve. And so people are calling for people's budgets, for freedom charters, for ways in which we can think differently about investments in social spending to address the problems that we're that people are facing. Because under neoliberalism and under broken windows policing, people with problems, like I said, lack of housing, lack of food, you know, get translated so that people are configured as problems themselves, as criminals. And this is just not a way to run any society.
Christina Heatherton is my guest. She teaches American Studies at Trinity College and is co-editor of Policing the Planet, Why the Policing Crisis Led to Black Lives Matter. You're listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. So in the last several years, we've seen this enormous fluorescence of movements against mass criminalization, Black Lives Matter being the most obvious. And I wonder what you think about the direction the movements have taken and the scope of their focus.
I hope movements continue to take the direction that a lot of them are taking, the direction that we feature in the book. And that just means thinking big. Thinking really big so that, you know, even though, I mean, you know, the history of social movements throughout the 20th century, especially the late 20th century, have so often been ignited by responses to state violence and, you know, particularly since the 60s through the present. We see, you know, all kinds of urban uprisings and social movements ignited particularly as a response to police brutality. So even though that's what kicked them off, that's not what constituted the whole of what people were working for. And I feel like that's what we're really seeing today. You know, what might have started as an outrage around the killing of Trayvon Martin, not even a police killing, and expanded to the police killings of people like Rekia Boyd and Michael Brown and Eric Garner, isn't, you know, simply limited to stopping the police from killing people. There's a kind of dialectical expansion, as there are in social movements, where people go from, you know, as they did in the Montgomery bus boycott, you know, first you boycott the buses, and then, you know, once you desegregate the buses, you try to desegregate employment in the bus system, and, you know, and eventually you're looking for desegregation and liberation in society as a whole. And I think there's a kind of scaling up of the movement as well, where people are thinking, you know, first from these intimate interactions with police, and then slowly thinking out, well, why is it that the police have this much power? Well, why is it that police and prisons occupy so much of city budgets? Well, why is this, you know, disproportionality taking money away from other parts of the state? You know, and how can we reimagine this whole apparatus? And so, you know, I guess I say that all as a way of saying it, this is not, you know, me speaking from on high about what direction social movements can be, you know, should be going to. The point of the book was to elevate the voices of people that are already, you know, doing, amplifying voices of people that I think we should be listening to. And movements like the Red Nation, a Native-led group out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Los Angeles Community Action Network in L.A., you know, are thinking about how you can ask for the impossible, how we have to think about a total reconfiguration of society, even if the movement starts initially as a response to a police killing.
Well, in the United States, you have a very racially divided working class. Mm-hmm. And policing has played an ideological role in maintaining those divisions. And I wonder if you could talk about the importance of ideology in all of this and sort of the political implications of certain sectors of the working class buying into that kind of law and order ideology.
Absolutely. On this point, I turn a lot to my co-editor, Jordan T. Camp. And it's an important thing to parse through because, you know, we can say, let's build a new society, let's all get together, easier said than done. And when we think about the operation of ideology under neoliberalism, we have to think about racism. We have to think about how race and criminality have been sutured under this economy. So that when people experience the degradation of the welfare state, it's not... You know, I mean, what's been so phenomenal under the rise of neoliberalism is you don't just see people doing without. You see people heavily, viscerally invested in the depletion of the state. I mean, look at any Trump rally for, you know, some portrait of what this kind of visceral engagement looks like. And it's because the neoliberal project has been so racially encoded. You know, people don't feel like they are stripping themselves, of something when they either vote for neoliberal policies, endorse neoliberal politicians, or stand by idly, you know, while local measures are, you know, voted on and implemented to starve schools and roads and hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. It's been encoded as... These, you know, there are no good immigrants coming to take, to be parasites on the state, and so you're stopping the undeserving poor from taking goods, the particularly the kind of myth of black criminality. A lot of people, including Jordan, have written about how. You know, that particular conflation of race and criminality has just, you know, it's been tremendous ideological work to oversee the largest prison building project in the history of the world. This is so deeply set. People do imagine the state as a zero-sum game. If somebody else is getting something, it must mean that they are losing. This is a racially encoded game, and so, you know, I think if our book does anything different, it says in order to confront neoliberalism, you have to confront racism, and there's no two ways about it.
So much of the focus of attention about the victims of police violence has, and with some justification, been about African Americans. But I wonder if you could talk about, and just end on discussing other racialized populations. I'm particularly thinking of Native Americans here, and their relationship to the police, because that seems to get lost often in a focus on the racial politics of the police.
Absolutely. Let me say at the outset that, you know, Black Lives Matter as a movement has... enabled the killing of Latinos in this country, of Native people in this country, of, Asian people, poor white people in this country, to register as not just an aberration, an accident of police violence, but as something systematic. And so, you know, I think this is really important for how we begin to understand a number of struggles together. And this is what we try to do with the book Policing the Planet. We try to think together things that traditionally have been thought apart. So we not only ask, you know, what does policing mean in an era of mass incarceration? We think about what does it mean in an era of mass deportation? What does it mean when Muslim communities are under intense surveillance and infiltration? And what does it mean, as you said, when Native people are the group most likely to be killed by police violence? In the book, I do an interview with a group called the Red Nation, which is an incredible Albuquerque-based Native-led group that's working for indigenous liberation and the overthrow of colonial capitalism, as they say. What's, I think, extraordinary about... what they put on the table is not that you need to think about Black lives and also Native lives, but how you think about what organizes and legitimizes state violence across the board. And, so this group, some of their insights, for example, thinking about where Native people in this country live, there's a kind of popular imaginary that Native people live in reservations, where, and as Their research shows 3/5 of all Native people in this country live in what are called border towns. These are towns just adjacent to reservations, but they're in U.S. cities, where their presence often registers as aberrant to, you know, public officials and police alike. And so they trace this over-policing, this criminalization, this mass killing of Native people to this conceptual aberration. You know, if Native people are not supposed to exist, or if they're not supposed to exist off the reservation, then how can you account or protect their lives within U.S. cities? I think this is such an important intervention. The particular argument is elaborated by two Native scholars, Nick Estes and Melanie Yazzie, who I hope will elaborate this in another work. But I think, you know, part of that interview and a lot of the other interviews in the book are an effort to broaden the conversation and bring together strands of a conversation that are already happening across this country and around the world.
And the book in question is Policing the Planet: Why the Policing Crisis Led to Black Lives Matter. That's published by Verso Books. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. I've been speaking with one of the two co-editors of the book. Her name is Christina Heatherton, and she teaches American Studies at Trinity College and is author of the forthcoming book from UC Press, The Color Line and the Class Struggle, The Mexican Revolution, Internationalism, and the American Century. Christina, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Sasha. Really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Thank you.